Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour is about to begin. Wherever you are in this Chill Pack nation, we hope you are making Empire State Gas your fuel of choice. Farm-raised and organically grown, Empire State Gas is celebrating the arrival of William Martin Stewart as the newest member of the Empire State Gas family. So if you mention his name at the pump all this week, you will receive a free Dynamic Duo t-shirt. Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
And now, your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Hello, Dean Haglund.
Hello, Phil Lairness. How are you?
Well, never mind how I am. Where the heck are you?
Wow, let's see. If this is Monday, I must be in Australia. Because it's
not Monday, though. It's Sunday.
All right, it's Monday for me.
Which means definitely you're in Australia.
Yes, Monday arrives in perfect working order.
And as always, I thank you for that look at the future. Can you please tell me literally what tomorrow's headlines will be?
More of the same, only larger.
Oh, yeah. So let me guess. Theater shooting somewhere in America.
Yet again, somebody's gotten really angry and taken it out using a gun.
Or a cleaver or a bow and arrow or whatever it was that guy brought to Mad Max Fury Road in Tennessee. You know, you hate seeing loss of life at all, but, you know, at least this time, the only loss of life was the perpetrator.
Right.
But I mean, this was a week after the one in, of course, Louisiana. And, I don't know if you saw, but the Aurora shooter got life without parole.
Oh yeah, I did see that. And that, one juror didn't want, everybody else wanted the death penalty.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think either of us are necessarily big death penalty advocates.
No.
In the words of George Carlin, it hardly seems like a penalty. It more seems like you're out of the game.
Exactly.
But we could have pointless, meaningless, divisive debates all along about whether it works as a deterrent, whether it saves money, which maybe is the most important thing. I don't know. But there is part of me that would like to actually see life without parole and to see this person paraded around so that maybe we can start to talk about, I don't know, mental health issues or something like that. But I will say this. There is part of me that, of course, is an animal that seeks revenge. And I do, part of me, believe in the idea of punishment. And that punishment should sting, and therefore, I don't know, the shooting took place during, what was it, Dark Knight Returns or Dark Knight Rises, whatever the third Christopher Nolan Dark Knight movie was. So certainly, I think part of his life without parole should be being forced to sit through that movie every day.
Wow, that's harsh. And if you believe in reincarnation, capital punishment is never a good solution because then they just come back having not learned a karmic lesson one would hope that life in prison, one would have a chance to reflect on one's deeds over time. And
that's actually very heavy that you brought that up. That is this the first time we've ever maybe even mentioned the reincarnation word, the R word?
I don't know. I think we have mentioned it before. I don't know if we've done it in context of an actual trial and court case, but
we talk about karma. Of course we talk about it, and believe it or not, it has been to a degree foremost in my mind because a screenplay you wrote called Karma Spree had scenes from it turn up in certain acting classes taught by one Phil Lernis.
Are you joshing me?
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, I should send you a video of a couple performers when they were doing it the final night of one of my classes. They really did some very interesting stuff with one of your scenes. I think you might get a kick out of it.
I would love to see that, actually.
But of course, it's a dark comedy, or not even a dark comedy. It's actually a fairly frothy comedy and a buddy road comedy about this concept of karma. And I think that actually is an interesting point when it comes to this idea of punishment, because I once asked a teacher, a very wise teacher, about this idea of reincarnation. And, and I asked the question in my youthful exuberance that I would, of course, come to hate to receive myself when we're traveling around with The Truth Is Out There, which was a question that begins with the words, "Do you believe?" In this case, right, I asked the teacher, "Do you believe in reincarnation?" But anyway, this wise old teacher said something along the lines of, well, here's the deal with reincarnation. If you believe in it, then we are signing up to be committed to the same patterns, lifetime after lifetime, until we do the work to change our relationship to those patterns. And then allow another pattern to emerge. And then the teacher said, if you don't believe in reincarnation, here's how it works. You're born into this life committed to certain patterns that will not change unless you are doing the hard work to change your relationship to those patterns. And I went, wow, so there's no difference. And the person said, no, indeed, there is no difference, except maybe since you're not guaranteed other lives, you might want to work on those patterns this time around, because this might be the only chance you have to free yourself.
Right.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah. It's the same work. It's just whether or not you think this is your only chance at it, or whether you think, I've got a couple lives to waste.
Well, I don't know. It's about a couple of lives to waste. It's perhaps the idea that you do the hard work, your entire life. So that it's not just a thing you do in your 20s and 30s and then, I got that all fixed. Now I can coast for the rest of my life. It's a continual process of doing this hard work right up until the very last breath, in knowledge that all that work is then transferred forward.
Right.
Well, and
there is no fixed. The point is that there is no fixed. The point is that it's constantly to just learn from it by recognizing the patterns, changing our relationship to them, largely by getting to that place where we would never change the patterns, even if we could. And once we accept them for exactly what they are and not what we would want them to be, then that transforms everything, because it transforms our emotional attachment to it.
Right. I think I agree with most of that.
And what you don't is simply due to the slight time lag between continents.
That's right. Right. The pattern that's happening there is that I'm already 17 hours ahead of you.
You are 17 hours ahead on the path. So if I said anything that was slightly incorrect, you really can't let me know about it, because that would be telling.
Well, consider it already corrected. That's how fascinating that is.
I don't know whether this is the worst opening of a show we've ever had or the greatest test record we've ever done.
I think it's a little bit of A, a little bit of B.
Dean Haglund, are you exhausted? You don't sound it, but you must. I mean, I know that you've been getting off on all this travel and all the excitement and the shows, and you just are having a ball. But honestly, if one were to look up whirlwind trip in the dictionary, they would find the definition of the phrase whirlwind trip, which is what you were on last week.
Yeah, well, it's been, 5 weeks now of solid plane travel. My air miles jumped by 55,000 air miles in the one, and that wasn't all on the same airline, even.
But last week, that was truly, it seemed insane to me, because at the end of all this travel, you got on a plane, flew, I'm betting, nonstop to Vancouver?
Correct.
And is that 15 hours?
15 hours, yeah.
And
14 in a bit.
And then the next day, were you on set?
Yeah, they actually changed my flight so that it was, next day was wardrobe fitting, because they needed to size me up. And then the next day was filming, followed by an immediate plane ride home.
Okay, and now I don't understand, obviously, because the amount of hours is so crazy and the distance is so crazy. I think of it, obviously, as you're heading east, northeast in this instance, but you're heading east from Australia to Canada. Is that right?
That is correct, yeah.
Okay, so do you have jet lag coming this direction or when you return back home?
You have it both ways, but it's a little harder flying east, because your timing, because you land before you took off on the same day. So that sort of screws you up, particularly if you stayed awake for 14 hours or if you slept for 14 hours. Either way, you've added an extra 14 hours to your day that you are now exactly...
Oh my goodness.
You know.
That's like the, I just saw a little bit of Men in Black for the first time in many, many years. It was on late at night after one of my classes. And Rip Torn, who plays Zed, just always knocks me out. And anyway, there's one point where he's looking at the control board and, you know, Will Smith as a new Men in Black is yawning or he's tired or something. And Zed talks about how they're on the standard Arcturan 37-hour work day, and don't worry kid, you'll get used to it or you'll suffer a psychotic break, one or the other. And that's how I feel, like you're on like the standard 37 hour day right now,
right? And on either psychotic break or you know, it's funny because I ran into an artist comedian, and he was like, oh, what are you doing? I'm taking 2 weeks off. Oh, why? Because I flew to Singapore. Like, wait, so you have to take 2 weeks off because you flew overseas? I've been doing that like every other weekend. Like, so I realize other people have to process that. But no, I feel remarkably chipper. I think the great thing was the long hours, of course, shooting the X-Files last week, was that it totally fit into exactly my schedule that I keep in Sydney anyway. So.
Okay, well, this brings up a few different points, actually, and we are finally getting into show business talk. But I mentioned that I'm teaching an acting class, and one of the things that I really, more and more, not just for actors, but for writers, directors, anyone involved in storytelling, you know, we live in a time, as you and I have talked about, where so many people feel the need to, you know, block out what's going on around them, block out what's affecting them in order to just get their daily work done, right? And the best thing about being a storyteller is you really are supposed to let it all in. You're supposed to let it all work for you. You're supposed to let it all serve. So your specific example, and I don't want spoilers. So I if you can answer this without, you know, giving away details in any way of, you know, where the gunmen are, what they've been up to, and this sort of thing. But based on who the gunmen were and the kind of lives they led and what they were interested in pursuing, you know, that kind of, those kind of hours, it seems to me, if you let that kind of weird energy in, It serves the performance.
It kind of does, actually. And without giving away too much, because if you read my tweets, you know I signed a confidentiality agreement that stopped me from tweeting, talking about it on podcasts, or putting it on Facebook, or talking anything about it in a comprehensive way. I even thought I was going to get around it by being able to draw sketches of the set. And even that in the confidentiality agreement was covered.
Like how we like how we got around licensing clips for Truth Is Out There.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Same way. I draw it that they are now hip to that and put a kibosh on my sketchbook on set idea.
But so did you find that these kind of hours that they do, I mean, because you were saying that it worked out well for you because you had just gone through this long day, but does it also help then? Do you let that into your performance and say, wow, this actually makes sense for the character as well?
Yeah, totally. And you have to take, yeah, everything you bring, you know, you never can arrive on set in a perfect state. There's always either some ankle injury or something, and you bring that into affecting your performance.
This is what I'm saying again and again each week. In fact, the reason that ankle injury might have happened is for the character, not for you. You know, if you even think in terms of, oh, I had this ankle injury, you've already separated yourself from the character. If you know you're going to be playing a character, you need to pay attention to everything that comes forward in your life as coming forward for both of you. At least ask, how does this serve us? So that you're not separating yourself from the character. And but it's funny. And the payoff for that, of course, is we don't know how to, as directors or even as audience, we don't know how to tell actors to do this. But boy, we sure know when we've seen real life. And I think a big part of that is when an actor lets real life in.
Absolutely. And if you think of Uta Hagen's always advice is go to art galleries, attend concerts, all of these things, because that informs you as an actor. I know so many actors could never understand that kind of acting advice, because it would seem like, well, that's taking me away from the work. But in fact, it's all the work.
So was it fun for you? I mean, it sounds like you.
It was abnormal, actually, in that, as I said, it was like when I crossed the international date line, 13 years had just magically erased itself. It as if time had not passed. Everybody looked great. Everybody was in a great mood. And it was just like the old days on set.
Well, and interesting enough how, again, you kind of manifested for yourself that kind of energy, because as we talked about last week and as you and I have discussed a little bit when we're not recording, you know, you really, the period, the way you've been living these last couple months and the enjoyment you've brought to it, a lot of it is reminiscent of when you were really heavily involved in like theater sports, and when you were originally shooting The X-Files and you were taking whatever break you had from shooting to go travel to a gig. You know, it's felt very reminiscent, and you seem to be enjoying the hell out of it.
Absolutely. You couldn't be happier. And, you know, talk about a gift that keeps on giving. It's only help matters in terms of, like, having the audiences come out again, new audiences finding the shows. It's been nothing but a sheer joy, I tell you.
So you shot for you had the day of the fitting. You shot for 1 day, 2 days?
1 day, yeah. We got it all done in 1 day.
And then you immediately got on a plane and got back.
Yeah, basically. Long enough to say hi to my goddaughter, have breakfast with her, and then head straight to the airport.
No ability to celebrate your birthday a week on with family or anything?
Oh, yes. No, the moment I land, my hotel wasn't ready, so I went straight to family and received some birthday gifts. And then got to my hotel.
And then cried yourself to sleep.
Exactly. With all my gifts surrounding me or my pillows.
It was, after all, a Monday. So now, are you going to have to do this again, or are you going to get to do this again? I mean, did they try? Are you going to have to do this again?
As far as I know, the answer is no, but Chris hasn't said he's written the last couple. So
it's possible. And as always, like you always said, the gunmen are given the least advance notice on these things.
Exactly. I mean, think of how little notice. I was in Hartford, Connecticut, and the panel there, we had no idea whether we were coming back.
You say that, but we're sitting in a car, and you're telling me on this show that Bruce has told you that the casting office has been trying to get in touch with you. So for you to say you have no idea is really you saying you willfully disregarded having any idea.
No, I didn't willfully. It was the casting office had willfully tried not to find me on my website.
Wow.
To go to deanhagler.com and hit contact.
My God, I can't believe we're going back over this. That is irresponsible on your part. The website that's constantly hacked and crashed, where the NSA filters your email, and anyway, you're a man unlikely to read your email to begin with.
That's semi not true. I put it in the semi.
Again, you have 17 hours in the future to take advantage of. For all I know, 17 hours in the future, you've become a man who does read his email. But based on past experience. Oh, my God. So I don't know if you can answer this one or not, but I would be remiss in not asking the final and most important X-Files related question. Are we going to see you in a wig?
I don't think I breach a confidentiality when I say there was a wig involved.
Above the waist?
Oh, wow. You know how that got shots look.
That got dark. That just, wow.
That totally got dark.
We may have mentioned reincarnation before, but I swear to God, that's got to be the first time the phrase above the waist has ever been uttered on this show.
And in discussing wigs, for sure.
All right. Well, look, we promised that we were going to start on a weekly basis discussing these lists of women-directed movies that everyone should see. I did not get started, so we will punt for one more week. Also, yes. I'm thinking next... I'm sorry?
Which one were you going to start with?
I don't know. I'll just bring one, and then that'll be your turn. It'll be like Movie Game. I will lead with Caught by Maggie Kiley, and you will see my Caught and raise me Concussion by Stacey Pearson. Who knows? That's kind of how
I
see it. And also maybe next week we'll introduce our new musical sting where we hear Garrett Watley get to say theater shooting of the week. So that'll be fun too.
Wow, really? We're making that a sting now?
Boy, wouldn't that be dark. I mean, I don't even know what to do with it at this point. I've got nothing... more to say. There have been films that I've been seeing that I want to chat with you about, because especially a couple of these are ones you have seen. But I was curious, you know, I've been catching up on movies from the 30s and 40s, really immersing myself in it. And I saw the 1936 movie version of the Broadway musical Showboat. And this was...
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so this was directed by James Whale. Frankenstein.
Yeah. Frankenstein. Think of that.
And it's so interesting, the direction on it, and the way that just through shot composition, he brings this whole awareness, subtextual awareness, to race relations in a way that, of course, the text itself had to avoid, had to skirt. And it's really wonderfully subversive at times.
Absolutely. And apparently the original Broadway show had scenes that couldn't make it into the movie because it was way more progressive back then than what the studios thought the rest of the America could see.
Sure.
I could see probably James Whale's upset that that was cut, then applies that cinematically over, because it's removed from the text, he can still imply that throughout the movie with the compositions and stuff like that.
And, you know, you think, okay, the guy who makes Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, what an odd fit. But no, you know, because he brings all that wonderful theatricality and turning these incredibly elaborate and rich and atmospheric sets into characters themselves. And it's a fascinating movie to watch. And, of course, it co-stars the great Paul Robeson, who I've been a fan of since I was a projectionist at UCLA, because I used to get to check out films, and I would check out the 16 millimeters of these early films that would star Paul Robeson. And it's almost amazing to think that one of the biggest stars of the era was this African-American man who was, of course, a former athlete, but was also a practicing attorney, and had multiple advanced degrees. Just this amazing, and an amazing singer. And
the opera singer, yeah. Did you know this? English, second language. He's Swedish.
Oh, my goodness. So he is a distant, relative of what, Eric the Red or whatever?
Eric the 14th. Yes, he's a distant cousin. He's a distant cousin from my family lineage of Eric the 14th.
So I also caught up on a movie you saw last summer, and I know you were looking forward to it, and then I think you may have really hated it, and it was Lucy from director Luc Besson.
Yeah.
With Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah. Boy, what'd you think? Before I revisit my deflated tire, I want to hear what you thought.
Well, I was really struck by how great the introduction of the setup was of this. She agrees to deliver this thing for a boyfriend. She gets handcuffed to this thing. You don't know what it is. You don't know who they are, but you're already tied with her point of view of not knowing anything. So you're sharing her state in all this. It's wonderfully effective, undercut by cutting back and forth to Morgan Freeman giving a nonstop PowerPoint presentation.
Yes, like a TED Talk.
And then, from there, and I remembered what you said, you know, the moment she makes this first jump to using 20% of her brain, you're in infallible, indestructible superhero mode. And so it's impossible to take any threat seriously. So it's uninvolving from that point forward.
Totally. And not only just uninvolving, it sort of undermines its whole setup, right? I mean, this idea of your brain capacity and the usage of your brain growing excrementally, and then it's like, excrementally, listen to me.
Yeah, excrementally. That was funny. I'm hearing the dogs lap up water in the background.
Oh, yeah.
And you're using words like excrementally. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm trying to remember how much I disliked that movie. But, you know, and I disliked it from a screenplay. It seemed like it had the feeling that executives jumped all over it and made it into this action thing. And probably there was a movie in there that was thoughtful about and as clever as that opening setup scene. But that seemed to get crushed asunder by making it a giant action movie. And a ridiculous ending.
All I can say is if people want to see a science fiction film with action and horror and suspense with a riveting and sexy lead performance by Scarlett Johansson that was released in 2014, they need to see In Her Skin? Is that the name of it? The one that I loved so much?
Yeah, that's the one.
Or is it Under the Skin? Under the Skin, is the name of it. I'm sorry. The other one was a Almodovar movie. So that's what people should see. Avoid Lucy. See the very great Under the Skin starring Scarlett Johansson from last year.
Yeah.
I also... Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I saw last night the one that you like so much, Mr. Holmes, with Ian McKellen.
I didn't even know you knew Ian McKellen. So the two of you were just hanging out. And
we were just hanging out. I did this movie called Mr. Holmes. And I said, oh, so I should see that.
And what did you think?
And I thought there's lots to be acclaimed for it. But I thought it was much more of a downer than you placed a...
Well, it is a downer. Of course it's a downer. But that to me is really inspiring. I find it very uplifting. I find it very cathartic when movies will mine that kind of terrain of deeply emotional and profound guilt and grief. I find that uplifting when storytellers are brave enough to do that. Instead of, like the Jonathan Demme film that I saw the other night, Ricky and the Flash.
Oh, no. What, with Meryl Streep as the...
Yeah, I'd been hearing that guilty. Meryl Streep might really jump the shark in this one. Jump the shark in this one. Postcards from the Edge was 26 years ago. Oh, my God. This thing,
Mia?
There is nothing authentic or believable in this movie at all, except oddly enough, when you are banking on Rick Springfield to bring verisimilitude to a movie, you're in trouble, and you're doubly in trouble when during love scenes you're worried that his face is going to pop off. But still,
wow! He's a lead character.
He's a lead character. He plays her boyfriend in it. Ricky and the Flash. This is interesting because Lily and I went to see it, and I went in thinking that it was going to be so awful it would hurt, and she thought it would be so awful it was delightful, and we kind of came out with opposite things. I was expecting so horrible that I enjoyed how bad it was. She expected it to be so bad it was good, and instead it was so bad it was bad. But anyway, the point that I'm bringing up, though, is these are people at this point in their lives as artists who have done fantastic work, groundbreaking work, legendary work. They are responsible for influencing all of us, inspiring all of us, teaching all of us, bringing out the best in all of us. All that said, right, these are people, Meryl Streep, Jonathan Demme, et cetera, who clearly do not give a fuck anymore. And you cannot say that of Bill Condon and Ian McKellen and Laura Linney and the people that made Mr. Holmes. These are people that are still trying to delve even in a story about as beloved and fictional a character as Sherlock Holmes.
Well, you got me there. That's certainly true. There was a lot of love to that movie, and I liked so much about it. So don't kid yourself. I'm giving it a hearty, I love it. But there were just aspects to it I wasn't prepared for in terms of...
Yeah, it's not your Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes. Don't kid yourself.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, exactly.
A movie that I have found myself involved in so many conversations about, so much so that I felt I finally needed to see it, was Ant-Man. And, of course,
Ant-Man.
Yeah, you didn't enjoy the Ant-Man. And America seems, critics have given it like 70-something percent positive. The audience, right, word of mouth has been pretty good. But, really, it's on the lowest rung of Marvel box office. And but meanwhile, I then get into conversations. Oh, our protege, Aaron Petrulis, hating the movie. But then I get in a conversation on the Midweek Drive on Siren FM. It's the one movie like this year that, Alex Lefchuk gave it a 10 out of 10, which, so let me see. So Citizen Kane, Wild Strawberries, Fellini's 8.5, Godfather Part 2, Ant-Man. We're all on the same level here, apparently.
Right?
That's a 10 out of 10.
Yeah, I can see not see that at
so,
all.
So anyway, but this was the fascinating thing for me, was to go into this aware that there was this disconnect between, you know, how you were describing the film, how Alex would describe the film, how any two people would describe the film. There was such a disconnect between the people who loved it and the people who didn't love it. And what was fascinating for me in watching it is you're all right. Because, because it's not a case of disliking it, in your case, because of what it's not, right? Which often is what you find with films when people criticize it, is they're criticizing it for what it isn't. I had a conversation with someone who was criticizing the movie that I loved that we talked about last week, End of the Tour, about David Foster Wallace and David Lipsky's short-lived friendship. They were criticizing it, saying, but that movie was so dull. And I said, what do you mean it was dull? And they said, well, nothing happened to it. There was no action in it, no nothing, you know. And I said, well, you realize that this is about what happened during those 60 hours that were recorded on audio tape that no one has ever known. Okay? They're telling a story about what really happened on that audio tape. If you find their depiction of that, if I, as someone who's interested in that, find that depiction to be unbelievable, unrealistic, lacking in authenticity, by then, all means, criticize the filmmakers. But to criticize it because they didn't add things that would excite you means you didn't do your homework before going and seeing the film. So choosing to see it, it's your fault that you think it's better, right? Because
right.
you totally
yeah,
wanted a different movie. You wanted Lucy with the title End of the Tour on it. So, but this is a case where you didn't do that. The people who are criticizing it have not criticized it for what it's not. They have definitely criticized it for what's there and for what doesn't work. I had heard many people say that it was the first time that Marvel had gotten a third act right, and I will agree they have. It is one of the best third acts. The problem is it's one of the worst second acts. It loses all momentum and becomes just exposition, and not only exposition, the same exposition over and over and over again.
And clumsy buildup to, hey, what does this bug do? And what does that bug do? Oh, I bet that comes in handy when I need that in the third act.
Yes.
Like, it is so transparent of like, this bug can do that.
You know,
it's in handy when I have to do that thing.
So that's what's fascinating about it, is that if you're willing to forgive it, then yes, everything that people have loved about it is in there. I do think it's interesting that you and Aaron and fans, people I know who were fans of The Lone Gunman, or in your case were and are again one of The Lone Gunman, don't like the movie because, you know, Edgar Wright, the original writer-director, depicted the three people who help Paul Rudd's character. He based them on The Lone Gunman because he was a huge Lone Gunman fan.
I did not know that.
Yes, and no wonder everyone hates them because The Lone Gunman were not insulting caricatures, unlike these three people in the movie, right? But that gets back to kind of what you said, which was you sort of wish you could see maybe what Edgar Wright's version of it would have been. And how that would be different. It definitely, you know, it's amazing because on the one hand, I compliment them because you managed to, you know, they managed to take this many cooks in the kitchen and come up with something cohesive. It really is. It is all those, the junky exposition aside, it is cohesive, weirdly in tone and look and pacing. It's cohesive of a piece. However,
right,
you also never for a moment think you're in the hands of a master storyteller.
Absolutely, and it feels like there is. It's laying pipe. And as the Easter egg, I don't know if you stayed to the end of the credits.
I did indeed.
Worst Easter egg ever. It was just like, oh, I know a guy. You know, I believe that's the one sentence that is said. And it's laying out that Ant-Man joins the Marvel Universe sort of thing.
To join the Avengers, yeah, in the next one. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
On the other hand, so there's the disappointing Easter egg, but the prologue said, I think in the 1960s, with John Slattery reprising the role of Howard Stark, maybe it's the 70s, but using the CGI technology to make both Martin Donovan and especially Michael Douglas younger, and then to make... Yeah. Haley Atwell, Peggy Carter, older, was very effectively used for the prologue. And it was a fascinating, again, from, you know, an acting standpoint and an acting teaching standpoint, it was easier for Michael Douglas and Martin Donovan to play young once you got the CGI of their face working well. It was easier for them to believably be younger than it was for Haley Atwell to be older. Because as we age and mature, we are able to harness those more youthful energies we have known and embody them, if only for shorter periods of time than we used to be able to. But boy, when you are 35, you have no concept of what 45, 55, or 65 will feel like. So that's incredibly hard for an actor to embody.
It's true. And I thought because I'm going to call her Peggy Carter, but because she has this tough as nails, but young, flinty energy, when she tries to make that older, it just seems... more rigid.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
so,
she
just stiffens up to try to play older.
Yeah. And in fairness to her, like I said, that's a very, very tough challenge.
Yeah, sure is.
So anyway, it was, I think as we use this technology more, the CGI technology, because it looks very promising, I think you will see it for actors to be made younger rather than casting younger and making them older. Because I think it leads to better performances that way. At least I think in the hands of good filmmakers, that's what you'll see. You know, obviously in this case, it needed to be Haley Atwell because it's been her in every incarnation, you know, as the glue a la Agent Coulson. You know, speaking of Marvel and the Marvel Universe, Fantastic Four opened and closed here in the States on Friday.
And, oh, no, that fast.
You know, some of the worst reviews ever, horrible flop at the box office. I'm sorry?
You look at that poster and you see the 20-year-old kid who's supposed to be Professor.
Well, they've changed the story. They changed the characters.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
so therefore, why bother going?
I mean, wasn't Johnny supposed to be the young girl's brother in it? And I don't know if anybody noticed they're different races in this one. But we got a great letter from Douglas about the Fantastic Four movie, and I wanted to run this by you because it's one of the really great ideas. And although we're running the risk that the multitudes of power players in Hollywood who listen to this show will steal this idea, I think Douglas would be, as I am, fine if someone steals it, because it would be a movie we would want to see. Phil, I'm not sure if the Fantastic Four means to you what it means to me, but this is one of the funniest reviews I've ever watched on YouTube, and he sent me that link. He says, I don't understand. He said, I don't understand why people are surprised, though. What they should have done is go back to the 1960s and then have a plot that Reed Richards' space adventure is the whole reason NASA had to hire Stanley Kubrick to fake the moon landings. I'm not saying it would work, but it's the movie I would make. Be well, Douglas. I think that's an awesome idea.
That's an awesome idea. So, that's pretty good. Reed Richards, yeah.
So, what Fox did with their other Marvel franchise, the X-Men, that's what made X-Men First Class so good, was going back to the 60s and playing with those events of the time. They did it wonderfully well. It breathed life into the X-Men and made the X-Men seem relevant again.
Yeah.
For at least one
part
movie.
Of history anyway.
Yeah. And you know, here you've got a Fantastic Four movie where even the director, the day before it opens, distances himself from the movie, which I hate. which I disapprove of, right? Especially the day before, once you find that all the reviews are really bad. He may be telling the truth, but you know, you waited until you found out what the fallout would be. So if it had been good reviews, you weren't going to say anything. That's dirty pool, and you don't make yourself look better, I think, as a director by saying it wasn't my fault, right? Well, hey, you still agreed to the project. You're the one who apparently didn't know who you had to make happy, and you're throwing everyone who signed up and worked hard for you under the bus by wiping your hands of it. I always find that distasteful. But he did. He tweeted saying, a year ago, I had a fantastic version of this film and it would have received great reviews. You'll probably never see it. That's reality, though. That was his tweet. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty harsh, isn't it?
Yeah. So he may be right. I was never going to see this Fantastic Four, but I doubt I'll ever see a movie by this guy. Again, it'll be a long, long time.
I might watch it if it's in the back of a plane seat. Don't kid yourself.
Yeah, I know you will. I know you will. But, you know, Marvel keeps chugging along both with their own movies, with everybody else's movies, with their own TV series, with everyone else's TV series, because Fox is now going to turn their X-Men franchise into a live-action TV series. And you know, meanwhile, of course, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has found a new villain, the Constance Zimmer, who has been scoring great reviews for a very little scene, but apparently terrific series on Lifetime with Greg Bierko called Unreal. She's joining the cast of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But I got to tell you, you know, I was a fan of this show and I tried it. And there is just so much good television that along with like House of Cards on Netflix, I don't have time anymore for something like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is never going to get it right. And which really feels utterly irrelevant. The only reason it feels like it's on the air is to keep it on the air. There's no sense that there's a story that they want to tell or characters that they really want to explore. I'm at the point with good actors like Clark Gregg and sadly, I fear it'll be like with Constance Zimmer where, you know, yes, it's a payday for them, but these are great actors. They deserve to actually get to do something.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, if I'm reading all those stories about the massive writer's room at Marvel and how all of these, the Ant-Mans and the upcoming movies and the TV shows, you have to line up all your boxcars behind this product locomotive. One of those boxcars is going to be shunted to the back of the train and it's going to get the least amount of attention. And I think that's become Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I mean, that's become just one more boxcar in this bloody.
But I don't think there is a boxcar at the end of it anymore. I think it's a perpetual motion machine is my point. Like the train in Snowpiercer. And so all the boxcars are just that. They're just boxcars. And so you don't see a passion or a love for any of it anymore. They all have it all planned out. All these boxcars got to be in motion so that we can get this whole thing in motion so that we can reach this destination. And so that magic of some of those earlier films where in the hands of these storytellers, there actually was a story you sensed that they wanted to tell. And not only that, it was always stories about how that which wounds us heals us. In the Marvel Universe, it's really, as I've said before, so inspiring because these characters' woundings are exactly what becomes the source of their strength. And it's exactly that I believe made this franchise, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, not only popular, but really, truly, culturally relevant. Only a couple years ago, they really were. They were culturally relevant. I'm not saying the popularity will go away, even though clearly it's crested. You know, this Avengers, 2/3 the business of the first one. Ant-Man, you know, the lowest grossing of any of the introductory films from Marvel. So it's crested and it's going down the other side. I'm sure they can still pull big audiences and big numbers and create big event pictures, but I think the days of it being relevant are over. And and audiences are going to look for something else, much like You know, I liken it to Star Wars, right? The second trilogy, which of course is the first trilogy, if that makes sense, they were very successful, hugely successful, in a corporate sense. But in a cultural sense, they didn't move the needle at all. Whereas...
At all, if anything, pushed it backwards.
Yeah, yeah. So so that's what's interesting is now I believe that we're going to find something that, because nature and culture abhors a vacuum, and we'll see something new move in to take its place. But it's hard because...
What that is, in my books, I've watched a thing on Netflix now that is so culturally relevant to me that it's taken my breath away. The animated series with Will Arnett, BoJack Horseman. Have you seen this?
I have not, but I just found out that Keith Olbermann, formerly of ESPN, formerly of MSNBC, and then now formerly again of ESPN, is one of the voices in it.
Oh, yes, he is, as is Patton Oswalt. Paul Aaron from Breaking Bad plays the guy on the couch. There's Amy Sedaris is in it, Catherine Shaw, like so many big comedy names in this thing. And it is hilarious. It is sad. It is so exactly what I live, but it's hilarious.
Well, I look forward to trying to catch that, binge watching that. I've got several that I need to look at, but I wanted to ask you about another one that clearly is culturally relevant, clearly moving conversation a great deal, and that is Game of Thrones. Have you ever become a fan of this?
Yeah, no. I don't know why it didn't really appeal to me. It seemed like, well, if you've seen the South Park parody, two-part parody about Black Friday shopping and the Game of Thrones coverage, it sort of nails everything I have the problem with the Game of Thrones. It's endless blackmail. It's endless. We got to liege with that faction, and this faction has to fight that faction. You know, great acting, characters aside, I couldn't really find a toehold into that thing.
I love what our friend Barb in Germany said, who appeared during some of our Mayan podcast-a-thon a couple years back. Yeah. She's terrified to watch Game of Thrones because she has this fear of food getting caught in those beards and having to look at that. That's her big thing. Like, she's so terrified that that will happen. But I'll tell you, here's news that not only might make me want to watch it, but to me is the whole reason you have a show like Game of Thrones in the first place. Max von Sydow is joining the cast this coming season. That's pretty cool.
That's going to be pretty cool.
You know, right? at a time when you have so many movie actors, movie stars turning to television, I don't know if you saw Antonio Banderas is going to be doing a Starz series, a detective drama called Havana Quartet, based on a series of novels. But, you know, at a time when so many actors are going from movies to television, Max von Sydow, that's kind of a big deal.
That's kind of a big deal. And he'll bring some gravitas to that for sure. I think, you know, you think of that career that he's had all the way back to Ingmar Bergman, for crying out loud. How could you not bring that kind of weight that show seems to have?
So that might just make me tune in, and I'll see if I can follow what's going on, because I don't know if I can go and binge 5 years of shows. But of course, there is enjoyment with that, and I think it's interesting that, you know, like Starz, I mentioned Starz with this Banderas thing, they're now starting to make entire seasons of their shows, new seasons of their shows, available for binge watching day and date when the first episode airs. And they're doing that with Da Vinci's Demons and both Flesh and Bone.
Oh, that's good.
Which is which is proof again of a way that, you know, Netflix, their cultural relevance and the way they have pushed things forward, because that's always been one of the appeals, right, of their shows.
Yeah.
I will try it because I know if I like it, I can keep watching it.
Yeah, exactly. And that it's going to continue. So, and if you don't like it, there's no harm in walking away from it either.
Absolutely. You get to find out really quickly whether the thing goes downhill. Whereas you've had to wait a year and then several weeks with True Detective, talking about something that was culturally relevant and then off the radar altogether. Have you seen the photos of the Lost posters? This is how quickly something can go from being relevant to a joke. There are these Lost posters, like Lost Kids or Lost Pets, and it says Lost Interest, True Detective Season 2. Call this number if you can tell me WTF is going on.
And that's hilarious.
And this went viral. On the other hand, the other show that debuted last year and also a little more slowly became culturally relevant, but certainly ended up being a talking point, was Fargo. And the trailer has dropped for Season 2 of Fargo. Have you seen this trailer?
No. So good?
Well, it's star-studded, which makes me nervous. You know, this idea of, oh, it was successful, so now every star wants to be a part of it.
Yeah.
But the trailer nails the tone. And they made the choice to go back in time to, I think... tell the story of what happened in Wichita Falls, which Keith Carradine's character keeps referring to in last season of Fargo.
Oh.
So that's kind of fun.
That's really fun.
And I'm also excited because although Billy Bob Thornton won't be in that, he is returning to episodic television on an Amazon series. He is playing the lead in my beloved David E. Kelly's new legal drama.
Oh.
Called The Trial. And it's a legal drama that follows one court case. And it was supposed to be Kevin Costner. And then I think Kevin Costner talks fell through because he may have gotten a little bit of cold feet about the idea of doing episodic, you know, whereas Billy Bob Thornton has already done it and enjoyed it and really appreciated the artistic opportunity. And so that's something I'm going to be keeping an eye on with great eagerness.
Oh, wow. Me too. I hope we get that down here. There's so many things that we have to dig for down here.
Even on Amazon? You don't think it would be available? The Amazon offers?
Yeah. Well, no, because Amazon blocks a lot of shows, as does Netflix. Even watching, trying to get Jon Stewart's last episodes down here is a trick.
Fascinating. You know, you and I produced a movie called The Lady Killers, which is mastering this month, which will premiere this fall. And I've been taking some meetings about distribution, and I learned something about foreign distribution and domestic distribution, and how one of the key ways that you really probably don't want to separate them. And it involves Netflix and Amazon and exactly what you're saying. And maybe I'll share that in a future installment where we're talking about what's going on with the movie.
I can't wait.
Meanwhile, you know, it's not just actors that are returning to turning to episodic television to find meaningful work. There's also filmmakers, formerly acclaimed filmmakers, are finding that they can reinvent themselves on television these days. You know, M. Night Shyamalan got the best reviews he's had since probably Sixth Sense with this Fox series Wayward Pines.
Oh.
And I'm about to binge watch that. And I was amused to see that following that the horrible reception of Aloha, Cameron Crowe is now going to be doing a TV series called Roadies, set within his wheelhouse of the music business.
Oh, right. Yeah. Which is sort of based on, the Rolling Stone reporter who followed the rock band and the groupie. What was that one called? Groupie?
Oh, Almost Famous, right?
Almost Famous, yeah.
So exciting stuff for us to compare notes on. We got to wind this down, but I wanted to ask you this. Have you seen, I guess you haven't, or you would have mentioned it, but I know you were a big fan of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Have you seen the new one, Rogue Nation?
It just opened here, and I can't wait to get to that theater to see it.
It is really fun. I can't recommend it more. It manages this really nifty trick, Dean, of being both a greatest hits of the previous Mission Impossible movies. Right. I won't give anything away, but you could go through all of it and go, oh, this reminds me of that scene in the first one. This reminds me of the motorcycle chase in the second one. This reminds me, while breathing new life into all those sequences and also having this kind of old prose grace and innocent sense of fun about it that's almost new to the... They hinted at it with the last one, but I got to tell you, this one... It brings you the joy of kind of classic James Bond at its best.
Wow.
It's that kind of, yes, there are deaths, and yes, there's action, and yes, there's violence and explosions, but it's really kind of light fantasy, and it's incredibly pleasing. Here they are in the fifth film of a series, and I'm not going to say it's the best one, but I will say that it's one where they master a delightful tone more than they ever have before. There were so many times when I actually was saying out loud, wow, like I was a kid again.
Wow, I love that. I'm glad that they can find the joy after five outings.
Well, I mean, and that's kind of, I think, how Chill Pack Nation feels about listening to this show. After more than 8 years, we still make them feel like kids again, Dean Haglund.
We sure do. Woohoo!
All right. Why don't I say goodbye to you, and then I'll wrap this thing up.
Right on. We'll talk next week.